it seems like ever since 2016, I give this talk once a year. And it changes a bit as I have done some research and reading on my own and use new sources. But I think it's really important in this very polarized time to start, not to start, I think we've all thought about how do we address, quote, the other. And also keep in mind, we're the other. It's whoever doesn't agree with us and that person with whom we don't agree. So it's polarizing. And the Buddha dealt with this himself in his own life, in his own Sangha. You know, you think in monastics have it all together, especially back in the Buddha's time with an enlightened person. They most definitely didn't. I had mentioned this a number of years ago. Dennis actually encouraged us to read it, and it was called a book called A Kosambi Intrigue. Anybody read it? Barb did. I definitely recommend it because it is about polarizing incident in the Buddha's time between his monks. And these are, quote, you know, monastics living the enlightened life, and they're not speaking to each other. And they actually split up, and people went to one area of this particular region, and others went to another area. And it was all over the way they were handling the drinking water. So, you know, this happens. No matter, apparently, how practiced you are, you're going to be dealing with this. And so some of this advice comes from the Buddha, and I recommend this book. I think some of you have seen it, Social and Communal Harmony, that Bhikkhu Bodhi, very well-known monk, put together, and it's been quite a resource for me. So I'm going to go over right speech, and I know so many of you have heard all about right speech, but I'm going to do it anyway, because we can never hear too much about right speech and be reminded of what it is and why it's so important. So remember, Noble Eightfold Path, this is our path. Here as Buddhist practitioners or as just people who want to do better in life, we follow the Noble Eightfold Path. It includes everything in our lives. It addresses everything. And it's divided into three trainings. The wisdom training, the virtuous conduct training, and the mindfulness and meditation training. So it starts with right view and right intention. These are the two wisdom factors. They are actually at the beginning of the path and at the end of the path. As they're perfected, they're at the end of the path. Right view and right intention. But right after that comes right or skillful speech. And I think it's really interesting that right after intention, when you're out in the world, here comes speech. This is what the Buddha considered so important. Caveat, Bhikkhu Bodhi, whose book on Noble Eightfold Path, I think many of us have read many, 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 many times, says when you're first starting on the path, I think actually for quite a while, it's a linear process. So you start with right view, right intention. You know, looking at what is your view of yourself and others, and what is your intention out in the world? And then comes right speech. And we work through the Noble Eightfold Path until it starts becoming holographic and it all informs each other. But right speech, Gil Fronsdale calls it mindfulness out loud. And I think that's as good a way as any of describing how we speak to each other. Being mindful about how we address each other. Now, I don't know about you, but I know I have said many, many things which come up in meditation which I deeply regret, especially before I started practicing and people I've hurt. And because so often we just react instead of respond. What's the immediate thing I want to say? And blah. There it is, and it comes out. So with our mindfulness practice, we are actually slowing down and responding, not reacting, hopefully. Also remember, we practice before, during, and after. So there's no mistakes. There's only, I've learned from this. If you haven't learned from it, that's a mistake. But if you've learned from it, it's not a mistake. It's setting you on the right course. So speech is mindfulness out loud. Words can inspire, they can provide hope, and they can create hate and hopelessness, all just with a few words. In our society, and this again comes from Gil Fronsdal, he said it might be more appropriate to say right communication rather than right speech or skillful speech. And you just think of some of the ways that you've communicated where you haven't said anything, a rolling of the eyes perhaps, you know, a sigh, a long sigh, you know, just a flippant attitude which says volumes. And people will not feel heard, feel they're disrespected, just with that alone. So four aspects of right speech. And again, for those of you who've been practicing forever, sorry, you're going to have to listen to all of this again. So the first aspect of right speech is being truthful. This is what the Buddha had to say about it. For the person who transgresses in one thing, I tell you, there is no evil deed that is not to be done. Which one thing? This, telling a deliberate lie. The person who lies, who transgresses in this one thing, transcending concern for the world beyond, there's no evil he might not do. It is said a bodhisattva, and the Buddha was a bodhisattva, the one thing he never ever did was lie. That shows you how important the Buddha placed being truthful. However, the caveat is, are you always supposed to tell the truth all the time, even if you know it? What do you think? Trick question. I just told you, you never tell a lie, but do you always tell the truth? No, why not?
It might be protected.
Might be harmful.
That's right, right. And there's five things to consider when telling the truth. First of all, and this is, I think, the most important one, is it true? You might think it's true. You might be, you know, holding some belief and, you know, parroting it, but is it really true? And that's a big one. Is it the right time to tell this truth? So in prison, for you prison volunteers, I know you've all done this, you know, we've often asked, okay, so you found out your cellmate's girlfriend is cheating on him, do you tell him? And the answers are always interesting. If they don't like the person, they want to tell him immediately. But if they like the person, no, you know, I don't think I should do that right now. That's the right answer. Is it kind? And that goes back to timeliness as well. Is it a kind thing to do? Is it going to be helpful for this person to know the truth? And there's so many instances where you have to weigh that. Is this going to be helpful to actually tell this person the bare truth about whatever situation? There is no right or wrong answer. This is where right view and right intention come in. How are we looking at this with wisdom? And then finally, are you telling the truth with compassion? Sometimes it's defined as, are you speaking with an open heart? If you're not, if you have a closed heart like the, you know, prisoner who, I want to tell him, I don't like him, you shouldn't be saying anything. That's a closed heart. And the reason you're doing this is not for the right reasons. So that's the first aspect of right speech, being truthful. Second is slander speech or divisive speech. essentially this is gossip. And I want you to notice when we talk about right speech, they go from easy to recognize to a little bit harder to do. It's like so many other things in Buddhist lists. I've noticed reading numerous lists, they go from, okay, I can notice this, getting a little harder, really getting hard. And for me, I think the whole aspects of right speech are, I'll follow that. So slander speech is speech intended to divide. The Buddha said he avoids slanderous speech and abstains from it. What he has heard from here, what he has heard here, he does not repeat there, so as to cause dissension there. And what he has heard there, he does not repeat here, so as to cause dissension here. Thus he unites those that are divided, and those that are united, he encourages. Concord gladdens him, he delights and rejoices in concord, and it is concord that he spreads by his words. So slander can be a weapon. And slander can, as the Buddha said, be as, I'm misquoting here, but something along as disabling as a physical wound. And those of you who have had slanderous talk about you, you know how deeply it hurts when you find out this has taken place. It's something that you keep with you, maybe for the rest of your life, just like the scar from a wound. The next one is harsh speech. We might think of this as swearing and the F word. And this is how you can see it gets a little bit harder. Think of yourself in a car being cut off by somebody driving crazy. Are you monitoring how you're responding? No, most of us just utter the harsh word. I mean, that shows the difficulty in trying to monitor yourself. But as we start to practice, hopefully that doesn't come up after a while. More concern for ourselves and others and, you know, how this person is driving. The Buddha said about harsh speech, he avoids harsh language and abstains from it. He speaks such words as are gentle, soothing to the ear, loving, such words as go to the heart and are courteous, friendly, and agreeable to many. And then the Buddha says there's three kinds of harsh speech, all coming from aversion or anger. And these are important to know because when we're speaking to the other, a person whose opinion we don't agree with, we sometimes succumb to this form of speech, and it is not forgotten. So abusive speech, which is scolding, reviling, or reproving another angrily with bitter words. Insults, hurting another by ascribing to him some offensive quality which detracts from his dignity. And finally, sarcasm. And I know some sarcasm, frankly, is kind of funny, but to the person who is being sarcastic to, it's painful. So speaking to someone in a way which ostensibly lauds him, but with such a tone or twist of phrasing that the ironic intent becomes clear and causes pain. So any of these tactics on this three kinds of harsh speech, any of those, if you're speaking to someone, you are guaranteed they are never going to hear you. Guaranteed. And even if you come back acting much more civilly, the damage has been done. You are not to be trusted. And I think you can think of some political figures who might have done that. And you weigh everything that is taking place because of divisive speech, because of lying. The last one, and this one, I know when I was teaching the Noble Eightfold Path course, a lot of talk about this. How is this even possible? Abstaining from idle chatter. This is, you know, frankly, I think for lay people, we are not monastics. I think this is almost impossible. And what I'm going to go into later, you actually use idle chatter to form, you know, some commonality. I think for monastics, and as you know, I'm my dear friend Aya Santachita, who comes and stays with me about once a month, and I adore her, and she's a nun. We really don't do idle chatter. We talk about the Dharma. We talk about difficulties in our own practice or where we feel we've done well. That's not the best way to put it, but you know what I mean. But she doesn't engage in idle chatter. I've got friends here who I engage in idle chatter with, and it's bonding. And I don't, frankly, I don't see anything wrong with it. But if you're a monastic, apparently that's something you abstain from. So as I mentioned, I think these four aspects of right speech are linear in difficulty, with idle chatter being the most difficult to actually abstain from. So mindfulness of speech, always thinking, is it my intention to divide or to unite? The Buddha brings that up over and over again. And the other thing we need to look at when we're holding a view and we are speaking of it, are we selfing? Is this to enhance our own egos? Is this a view that we've held on to so long that we don't even see any other view? We just accept it as this is correct. We all tend to do this. It's our human nature. With mindfulness, we start questioning this. And one of the reasons we have a meditation practice is that stuff starts to come up. And you might start questioning your own view on something. Does this really make sense? Is this just the way I've been taught and I'm comfortable and I've created this self around this, so I'm not giving it up? That's really being honest. That's really using right view to monitor what's going on, both in your meditation and in your daily life. So, all that said, how do we speak and listen to those with whom we have pretty strong disagreements? And I'm thinking in terms of political, cultural, perhaps spiritual, not talking about families and dynamics, you know, with a husband or wife or kid, because that gets into too many other areas. This is, I want to address more the polarity that's going on in our country now, which is, you know, becoming, you know, toxic, has been toxic for quite a while. So speaking to the other. And again, when I finish this, these are just things I have thought of, or George Marshall, who talks about how to speak to climate deniers, how to skillfully do that. It's kind of a conglomeration of those. And you might have others, and I hope you do. And that's when we will not record anymore, when I finish, and you can share whatever you have found, or anecdotes that you've got that you found were helpful in your own lives. And I hope some of you will share that. So what I have found, and George Marshall certainly emphasizes this, and the Buddha does as well, don't argue. Don't ever get into an argument. It's not going to work. And you just think of arguments that you've had. A heated argument, it gets so heated, do you stop and think or say, you know, you're right? You don't. What we tend to do is constrict the sense of self, and even if we're starting to doubt our stand, we're going to hold on to it because we're feeling in danger. The self has been challenged. So arguing is never, ever going to get a point across from you, and you're not going to get it from somebody else. It's not going to happen. What you need to do instead is you need to find something that you both agree on. And George Marshall really emphasizes this big time. You need to find a place of friendship And no matter who it is, unless somebody is just rabid, and the Buddha talks about some of these people who are just rabid, really don't want to hear anything. I'll go into that later, but most people want to have a commonality. They want to be able to have a discourse. They want to hear and they want to be heard. But you have to find a commonality. And so that could be children, grandchildren. I know for me, dogs is a big one. Are you a pet owner? There's always something that you're going to enjoy and want to learn more about from another person. It could be leisure activities, your plans for the future, where are you going to vacation, you know, any number of things. As long as you start with something where there's some civility and you see each other as people and not adversaries for that little brief period of time, that's where you can start. I read a thing in the New York Times a couple of days ago, and this is something I thought was really concerning about how we just don't have civil discourse. 42% of Republicans and Democrats think the other is evil. This is to quote them, "Hatred has become the defining emotion of our political life. According to a recent sociological paper, 42% of the people in each party regard their opposition as downright evil. Nearly 20% of both Democrats and Republicans believe that their political adversaries lack the traits to be considered fully human. They believe the other acts like animals. Roughly 20% of Democrats and 16% of Republicans say the world would be better off if large numbers of the other party died." So that's how polarizing we're getting. When I first started giving this talk in 2016, I never thought this is where we would end up. But this is what is starting to happen. So find a commonality. I had something just happen. My birthday was a couple weeks ago. And for my birthday, my biological family is very small, so my husband, I inherited his family, which is very large, which is very convenient. So my stepchildren and step-grandchildren, it's great. So I invite them all to come over to my house and help me landscape every year. So there's 16 of them, and they came over. And we had this wonderful time, and then I said, I'll take everybody out to Spaghetti Factory afterwards. A lot of little kids, you know, Spaghetti Factory. My step-grandson is a deputy sheriff in Nevada County, and I'm a Buddhist minister. He's an evangelical Christian, and he's one of my favorite people. And we have, our commonality is the criminal justice system. While we both come from completely opposite ends, we both agree it doesn't work. It's not creating safety, and it's certainly not helping people who are leaving prison. So we agree on that. And as we sat down for dinner, I happened to be sitting next to him, and we were talking, and he ordered a vegetarian meal. This is a meat and potatoes guy. And I said, Tim, you're not eating meat. And he said, no, it's your birthday and I want to make you happy. So, commonality. Find something you can talk about and it starts spreading. Listen and ask questions. You know, Susan Ord was, before she died, was putting together a listening course. And I think it's probably one of the most important courses anybody could take, actually learning to listen to each other. And it's easy to say, I listen. Most of us don't listen. We're waiting for our chance to say something better, to be profound, to show how intelligent we are. We don't really, really listen. Mindful listening is a skill that needs to be developed. And here's the great thing about listening. When you listen to others, really listen to them, they tend to think you're the brightest person in the world. They think you're smart. They tend to listen to you when you have something to say because you took the time to listen to them. Really, really listening. And the interesting thing is, as you listen to people, with especially completely different viewpoints, you might find out some really interesting things about them and why they came to the conclusion they came to, which you might never, ever have considered. And it opens up the door to understanding and to meaningful discourse. Always give people respect for their viewpoint. They've obviously thought about it. You might not agree with it, but they've put thought into it. And you ask them why, give them credit for that. And as George Marshall says, to quote him, he said, "I don't agree with you, but I admire how much thought you put into your perspective." I know, I will go into that later. This is really, really important. Talk about your personal journey. Talk from an I point of view. Don't talk about, like if you're talking to an evangelical Christian, well, the Buddha said, no, forget that. They don't care what the Buddha said. But you talk from your own personal point of view. I find, for me, meditation really helps calm my mind. Maybe that's as far as it goes. If you're talking about spiritual differences, no one can argue with you about your own experience. They can't take that away from you. If you're honest and sincere, and this is why I do what I do or believe what I believe, that's it. And they can share why they tend to believe what they believe. So you focus on your own truth, not others. Also, don't be so naive as to think what others think. And I just made this mistake the other night in prison, and I've got the view that because most of our inmate Sangha members are either African-American or Latino, unfortunately, but I think they're all liberal. I assume. And I was talking about right view, I think I was talking about climate change deniers and holding on to view, something like that. And the guys were very attentive and listening. And the evening ended, and this one very tall African American man with dreads and tatted up, and he said, "That was really interesting." I said, "Oh well, thank you." And he said, "I'm a Trump supporter." And he said, I hadn't thought about climate change in the way you put it. And he goes, "But it is something to think about. And I am so glad I did not start railing on Trump." Because that would have, and unfortunately, that has been my inclination. And I'm trying not to do that anymore. Because I don't want to alienate and cause any more problems that we've got already. I've got my own viewpoints. I'll vote my own way. But people have reasons for why they're voting their way. And when I talked to this young man, it was very interesting, the reasons he gave. He was a Trump supporter. Things I would have never, ever thought about. And they were valid reasons. There's also times to not engage. I'm going to read from what the Buddha said about this. And that, the only advice is, when somebody is not interested in you, they're not interested in hearing about you, they're not interested in anything except just screaming their own version of the way the world is. That guy who's been banned from Facebook, Alex Jones, I think his name is, is a good example. People who, there is no discourse. It's just my way or the highway. So this is what the Buddha said about it. What kind of person is to be looked upon with equanimity, not to be associated with, followed, and served? Here, some person is prone to anger and easily exasperated. Even if he is criticized very slightly, he loses his temper, becomes irritated, hostile, and stubborn. He displays irritation, hatred, and bitterness. Just as a festering sore, if struck by a stick or a shard, will discharge even more matter, so too, just as a firebrand of the tinduka tree, if struck by a stick or shard, will sizzle and crackle even more. So too, just as a pit of feces, if struck by a stick or shard, becomes even more foul-smelling, so too, some person here is prone to anger and displays irritation, hatred, and bitterness. Such a person is to be looked upon with equanimity, not to be associated with, not to be followed, not to be served. Be sure to think, he might insult me, revile me, and do me harm. Therefore, such a person is to be looked upon with equanimity, not to be associated with, followed, and served. From the Buddha, from the Buddha's own mouth. Here's something interesting that I just heard yesterday, as a matter of fact. I have a favorite podcast. I've got a couple of them. I've mentioned some of them, but this one's called Hidden Brain with Shankar Devanand. I think he's just great. He's a sociologist and, you know, follows sociological studies. And I went back and I think this was 2017. And he interviewed a guy named John Hibbing, who wrote a book called Predisposed: Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Difference. Has anybody heard of this book? Well, it's really interesting because he goes into actually the psychological and genetic differences between liberals and conservatives. And obviously, they're psychological, but I didn't realize there was actually genetic differences. And he said there are genuine psychological and neurological differences. When I heard this, for me, it makes it easier to be with someone who has a difference than me, a different bent. It's almost like somebody from a different culture. You know, you would try to get to know them. You would try to understand them because they come from a completely different place and they can't help it. They were born there. You know, there's nothing to hate. It's just the way it was. So he said his research is, where do our political views come from? And most believe it comes from our parents. I started thinking about that. Or maybe it is the opposite of our parents, but it's still but it's still influenced by parents. And he said political differences between conservative and liberals is not limited to just politics. Everything about the two is different. The food we eat, and they did studies. They found out conservatives like meat and potatoes and liberals like ethnic food. Conservatives like predictability, liberals like new experiences. Conservatives tend to be neat, liberals tend to be messy. And they say these are averages. This isn't, you know, always. It's just a proclivity that they have found. Their living and workspaces are different. Sports memorabilia can be found in conservative homes, while items from around the world can be found in liberal homes. Pets. Conservatives like purebred dogs, liberals like rescues. So that was just one of the things that was different. Psychological traits. Conservatives believe in protecting our way of life from others. We always have to be vigilant about it. That is their biggest concern. For liberals, climate change and having a more welcoming attitude. And you'd see the two are completely different. There's nothing wrong with either of them. It's just there's an emphasis on one rather than the other. Both say of the other, they just don't get it. We think that if others don't see the world as we do, sociologists calls it false consensus, thinking everyone thinks the way I do and it's the right way, and if they don't, you know, they're idiots. We actually experience the world in completely different ways. And here was the really interesting thing. There's differences in our brains between liberals and conservatives. So they did a study, and they showed a series of pictures to groups of people who said they were liberals and conservatives. And some were positive and some were negative. Liberals most responded to the positive images and conservatives the negative images. They later looked at brain scans, and with almost complete accuracy, they could tell from brain scans who was liberal and who was conservative. And this is where the biology comes in. Then they did a study on twins, fraternal and identical twins. And I'm not going to go into it because I want to hear from you, but 30 to 40% of political views they determine come from genetics. Born that way. Isn't that what Lady Gaga said? Was born that way? That does leave 60, 70% from the environment, but I think it, for me, it just puts a new twist on the whole thing that people really, brain-wise, think differently. It doesn't mean they're wrong, but it means we have to learn to be able to speak to each other. Okay, I'm going to be wrapping up with 20 minutes to go. Just making sure I don't have something brilliant that I've left out, which I usually do when I go home and I thought, oh, why didn't I say that? Jeez.
That's not right speech.
Thank you. The Buddha had something to say about this. Don't argue a point where the person has no experience or interest in learning more about something that you consider important. You know, hammering home on something. And they have absolutely no interest. You know, you're just really wasting your time. And surprisingly, the Buddha addressed this, and he said, monks. Okay, monks, but, you know. A talk is properly addressed when, having weighed one type of person against another, it is addressed to these five appropriate types of persons. What five? A talk on faith is properly addressed to one endowed with faith. A talk on virtuous behavior is properly addressed to a virtuous person. A talk on learning is properly addressed to a learned person. A talk on generosity is properly addressed to a generous person. A talk on wisdom is properly addressed to a wise person. Some of the best talks I've had on spirituality are with his name is Imam Mikhail, Muslim chaplain at Dual Vocational Institution. He is a spiritual person, and when I go down there, I try to get in early because I just love having conversations with him and finding how much we have in common. In fact, Kathy, I would love to have someone like that visit and have, you know, a conversation with them, because there's so much we have in common that we just don't know about because we don't talk to too many Muslims. At least I don't, except for Imam Mikhail. So I'm going to finish up, and I'd like to hear your own experience with this topic, what you have found has worked and hasn't worked. Remember, practicing before, during, and after. As long as we learn from it, it's important. It's a teaching. And with that, I'm going to turn this off.